I was driving the catering truck for my parents' business, and he had these older people, who could barely see over the dashboard, pulled over for some traffic violation. Andy was smiling, and he had these big teeth. I'm telling you, I could see these white teeth, and I kept staring at him as I drove by and was wondering who the heck the little dude with all the teeth is, she says, smiling broadly, then blushing at the memory. Her accent is classic Eastern Ohio, where the sentences end in a preposition and the ends of words are bluntly clipped, as if the speaker is trying to get to the point faster, using the fewest vowels and consonants possible. It is a legacy of the early Scots-Irish settlers who migrated here centuries ago. I just kept thinking about him, that smile. And then a week later, there was a riot at one of the bars that me and my sister were at. We go there and dance and shoot pool and darts and stuff. There happened to be a riot that night, and I happened to be there, and he was one of the cops that came. And I told my sister, I said, I think I'm going to go out with that guy. They still had never met. It wasn't until months later at her son's Little League baseball game that she realized his son played on the same team. I wasn't sure if he was married. He wasn't sure I was married. Then his daughter asked my daughter to play Barbies in the car while the boys were playing baseball that I found out he was divorced. Then I just kind of knew it was destiny, she says. Renee Dibble grew up in the heart of the city of Ashtabula to working-class parents who were driven to succeed. Sometimes I'd say too much, she says, explaining her childhood. I spent most of my time with babysitters. My parents owned their own business, a catering business, and I was raised as an only child for 10 years with workaholic parents. 10 years later, her parents decided to adopt, and during the adoption process, her mom got pregnant. Yeah, when I was 10 years old, I got two sisters, she says. As a child, Dibble went to a Catholic elementary school. It was church like every day, and then it was church with my dad, because mom was Protestant, dad was Catholic. So mom didn't go, just daddy. It was dad and I. And then she would stay home with the little ones after we got them, and so it was just dad and I, she says, smiling at the memory of the special time she spent alone with him. When I was 10, we moved out into the country, got horses and a goat, you know, stuff like that. In junior and senior high, she attended public schools. Both of her parents were staunch Democrats. After high school, she worked for her parents. By then, in addition to their catering business, they bought a bar. Mom also had a craft shop, she explains, and sighs. Her body language is evident. Her parents' prolonged absences impacted her. We had three businesses at one time, and it made it hard. So as a child, I was raised by babysitters, mainly my grandmother. And then when the two little ones came, either one or the other would be home, just a little bit, but they were workaholics. They really were. It was constant, she says. It was hard, she repeats. She spent a dozen years after high school working for her parents, and then decided to go back to school. Only 'cause my baby sister talked me into it, she says of her biological sister. She graduated that year from high school, and she asked me if I would take the test, 'cause I took her to go take her test down in Youngstown, and it's like, ugh, I really don't want to do this, but I'm going to take it for shits and giggles, basically. Both she and her sister attended ITT Technical Institute and got secretarial certificates, but neither sister used her associate's degree. The blended Dibble family then expanded to 6, but that did not last long. We ended up building our own house out here in Jefferson when the kids started getting older and just bursting and stuff. But my adopted sister, the one that's in the middle, gets into some trouble. She ended up getting pregnant and having a little girl. When the baby was born, the baby wasn't in good shape and needed a stable home. So she signed her over to me. So that's how we ended up with number 7, she explains dispassionately, as if reciting her mailing address or social security number. But she does not stop there. I was a bus aide for Ashtabula City School Systems. There was two little boys, two little black boys, she says, as she points to their military photos on the mantel. My pictures are up there, a couple of them, she says, and smiles. Tears form. She brushes them away. They were living in a home-safe shelter with their mom and younger brother and sister, and they were in kindergarten and the first grade. They came on the bus every day with these oversized, ill-fitting clothes. Their shoes were falling off their feet because the clothing that they had and the shoes that they had were what was given to the home for spare clothes for the kids who were there with a parent, she explains. I told my husband, one day I'm going to end up bringing these two little boys home to play with Nick, who was 4. That's our biological son. I told him I couldn't handle this. These poor little guys are just, they just make my heart bleed. Their clothes are always dirty. They wear the same thing for weeks at a time. I can't handle it. Her husband's response was that of a devoted husband used to his wife's big heart. Yeah, yeah, okay, okay, he told her. The two brothers, Matthew and Devin, were a bit older than Nick, at 5 and 6 years old. But the boys became fast friends, and Renee had fallen in love. The playdates soon became sleepovers, which soon became the boys living with them full-time. They had been with us for a few months, but then the mother ended up taking them back. Then one day she called and said she was moving with the kids to Cleveland, Dibble explains. My heart was broken. They were like my kids now. After they moved to Cleveland, between Thanksgiving and Christmas, Dibble would call them every other night. I called New Year's. We just pulled into my friend's driveway, and I had called to wish them a Happy New Year's and all that. Shortly later, the mom called me back, and it's to ask if we would take them for a couple of weeks. She had decided to leave Cleveland and move back to Ashtabula in a few weeks, and she wanted them to not have to keep changing schools until she got back. The Dibbles picked up the boys on the second day of January, and when March rolled around, they still had them. It is 1998, and I get a phone call from Children's Services in Cleveland. They said, "Do you have these two kids?" And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "We'll be there to interview you and possibly pick them up." I said, "You're not taking them anywhere." Their mom had had another child at home that was born crack addicted, and then found out that the youngest one that we had was also born crack addicted. And there had been 3 others from him on down. That was 3 kids that were born crack addicted. She's had, oh my God, 10 kids and never raised any of them, she explains. So, here they are, she says, pointing to Matthew and Devin's photos, bookending her biological son Nick in the middle. Still our kids. I guess they're both in the Marines and doing pretty well. She beams. Over the next 10 years, the Dibbles became foster parents and eventually adopted 2 more children. So our youngest is 10. We got him and his brother. They're 10 and 13. So we decided to stop now. With 11 kids, she is exhausted. I don't like kids anymore, she deadpans, then smiles. Just then, James, her youngest, walks in. He is put in charge of bringing the dogs, 2 Yorkies, Sophie and Lexi, in from the backyard. He politely balks. Oh, my gosh. I said go get Lex, honey. Oh, that's Lexi rolling in the chicken coop. That's the thing to do. Go get her, please, honey. He doesn't like bugs, she says, rolling her eyes at her son, explaining his aversion to going outdoors. James relents and goes outside. He loves his mom and is silently willing to let a stranger know it. The breast cancer hit Dibble in the middle of the night in 2015. It was in March, sometime after midnight, and the blonde Yorkie, the older one, had to go outside. And I let her out that door, and when I did so, and it's really weird the way it happened, because why did I not feel this sooner? Because already it was a good size across the top of my breast. Anyway, I leaned, I crossed my arms, and put my head against the door, and when I did that, it felt just right on the top of my hand, and I said, "Something ain't right. That doesn't feel right." Well, then I felt it, and it's like, I've got a lump. The next day, she visited the doctor, who told her to skip the mammogram and go straight for a biopsy, and asked sternly and urgently if she had a surgeon she preferred. She was shocked at the suddenness of everything. But it's 1 year later as she replays the story, and she is in remission. She had complications with the incisions and wasn't healing properly. She has been off from work for the longest stretch of her life. "I'm a full-time bus driver, yeah. But I had to take this whole year off. It has sidelined me a bit." The cancer has stagnated the family's income for the present and for the near future. She says she feels pretty good, and then she says this. "Well, except they're watching a spot on my right breast that's got a bit of a lump. Yes, I've got a lump, almost at the same exact spot that I had the lump the first time. Going to keep an eye on it. It's about 2 centimeters, and if it decides to get any bigger, if it does grow at all, they're going to go ahead and they'll do a biopsy and just take it from there. That's fine with me, because, you know, I'm not nursing kids anymore these days, and my bikini days were over 30 years ago. You can take both them girls," she says, pointing to her breasts. "I don't care." She is clearly the kind of woman who does not dwell on things she cannot control. Like I always say, I am the kind of person who doesn't let any grass grow under my feet. Both Dibble and her husband were raised Democrats and have always voted Democratic. She says they did not care for Barack Obama, but they also didn't care for John McCain or Mitt Romney. But then came Donald Trump. For her, the attraction to him as a candidate was instant. She even switched her registration so that she could vote for Trump in the Ohio Republican primary, helping Trump rack up a 7-point win in Ashtabula over home state governor John Kasich, even as Kasich was carrying the state as a whole by 11 points. "What Trump had to say was as if he had been part of my community all of my life. He understood the economic problems, the decay of our society, and that drain of our treasure, our children, out of our communities, because there are no jobs or future in Ashtabula for a young person," she says, articulating a common concern among Midwest voters who have watched their communities bleed young people for 3 decades. That pull is very real for people who have lived here for generations, the sons and daughters of the sons and daughters who carved out a decent life here cannot do the same for their own sons and daughters. "It makes you feel weak and powerless," says Dibble, "like you have no control to hold your family and your community together, because you have no future to offer them." The sentiment is expressed in census statistics. Ashtabula County's population peaked in 1980 at 104,215. It's 98,231 today, and sliding by 0.5% every year, exemplifying the entire state of Ohio's population flatline, while the Sun Belt grows. The county, which was once an economic engine, with chemical and power plants and bustling wharves on Lake Erie, now has an unemployment rate of 5.8%, which ranks it as just 60th best out of Ohio's 88 counties. Dibble's feeling of powerlessness led her to do something in October 2016 that she had never done before in her life. She went online and signed up, along with her husband and one of her sons, to attend a political rally. "I was like, oh hell, I'll try it. So I went ahead and I did it, and I got tickets. Well, then I got a hold of my husband, and I'm like, "You're not going to believe what I just did." He's like, "What?" And I said, "We're going to go see Trump." He said, "I am not going to go see Trump." I said, "Yeah, you are. I got 3 tickets." And he's like, "How did you get 3? I said, "This is what I did." And he's like, "Okay." So I called my son Nick and I said, "Listen, this is what's going on. I got tickets to go see Trump. Do you want to go?" And he's like, "You gotta be kidding me. I've always wanted to do something like this. But when do you ever get the chance, you know?" And off they went. Trump's rally in Geneva was local history in the making. The last time a presidential candidate had come to Ashtabula County was 1960, when John F. Kennedy stopped there during a cross-country train tour. The local paper reported that many in the crowd of thousands had been lined up for hours to witness Trump's speech. He railed on Clinton in his rally, not for her liberalism, as most other Republican presidential aspirants would have done, but for her elitism. "The elites in government, like Hillary Clinton, believe they are entitled to do whatever they want," Trump said. "She lives the high life off the rigged system." Before they went to the event at the Spire Institute, an Olympic sports training facility, the Dibbles were a little apprehensive due to what they'd seen of previous rallies on cable newscasts. "Well, you know, a lot of the portrayal was these rallies were negative. The people there are terrible. Then you go there, and now trying to explain what the atmosphere was like is difficult. It was so positive, and my expectation was that it wouldn't be," Dibble says. "To me, it was really exciting. We had our banners. We still have them, the Trump banners. I got like one in every color. And I couldn't believe how even my husband, who is on the quiet side, was enjoying it and raising the banners with everyone else. It gives me goosebumps just thinking about it. You have to understand, we've never done anything like this before. We are not those people," she says, echoing another characteristic of otherwise hard-boiled rough rebounders, their own surprise at the level of enthusiasm they had for a candidate for public office. 12% of the Trump voting respondents in the Great Revolt survey report either attending or having an immediate family member attend a Trump campaign rally like the one in Ashtabula County, a key element of his campaign strategy. Trump was never expected to do well in this northeasternmost county of Ohio. President Barack Obama had bested Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney here by 13 percentage points, and neither President Bush ever carried the place for the GOP. But when Trump did, carrying Ashtabula by a shocking 19%, and washing in a slate of local Republican candidates with him. It's a story repeated in hundreds of Midwestern communities where most every other Republican since Reagan had failed. In Ashtabula, Trump got 23,318 votes, which was 4,000 more than Mitt Romney had earned in 2012. Two local GOP candidates for county commission, the local legislature, rode his coattails with similar vote totals, wildly exceeding the GOP commission candidate totals from 4 years ago. A Republican candidate for an open state Senate seat also carried Ashtabula. The unbroken row of local Democrats in the courthouse offices, such as sheriff and prosecutor, likely only survived because they ran unopposed. Ashtabula is a portrait of Rust Belt America. The county hugs the shore of Lake Erie, where the port of Ashtabula was once one of the most important shipping and commercial hubs in the region. Coal and iron and the other hard physical products of 5 states passed through here on their way to the world. Its votes and voters have almost always been reliably blue. The Democratic New Deal imprint on its election returns has been as indelible and as evident as the New England influence of its earliest settlers was on the county's famed wooden-covered bridges. Political experts and reporters have diagnosed Trump's disruption of Democratic streaks in places like this as the consequence of voters who are either uninformed, stupid, angry, or racist. And that rankles Renee Dibble. Racist. Every time someone throws that at me, I spit right back out. Let's see. Our daughter that we've adopted is biracial. I got 200% black sons. I've got a half-Japanese grandson, a biracial daughter-in-law, and a daughter-in-law that is half Puerto Rican and half Mexican. I'm racist? I love it when people say, especially if they're black or something, and they say, you don't know about me. You don't know about, well, you know what, buddy? You have no idea who you're talking to. My family is, well, we are like a rainbow family. We're all mixed. It does not matter what color you are. And we voted for Trump because it's, obviously you are not too intelligent either. Oh my God, that's a bad subject, she says, clearly agitated. Voting for Trump has changed Dibble. I don't see politics the same way anymore. Before, I saw it as this other thing, this thing I wasn't part of, this club where I didn't belong. And now I see it as a moral obligation, not just for myself and my family, but for my community. If Hillary Clinton had won, and a woman with Renee's background had said she was the mother of a rainbow family, and that is why she cast her vote for Clinton, she'd be cast as the billboard for a public service ad campaign about empowerment. But empowered is not the kind of word most observers use about Trump voters. So to ask what would extricate me from Trump would be like asking me to remove me from myself, from my family, and from my community, she explains. Her displeasure with traditional politicians in both parties has been twofold, job creation and direction. They have taken this country on the wrong track and ignored the economic conditions that were deteriorating right before their eyes. Ashtabula has been deteriorating since 1990, not since July of 2016. This is every politician's fault for the past 30 years. They have managed the decline while getting reelected off of our empty promises, she says. Dibble outlines the contours of a third political movement, one that checks the other two while keeping its eyes wide open to the faults of its standard bearer. It's not that I think he is perfect, but we didn't want perfect. The reason I think, and my husband will tell you the same darn thing too, it's because he tells it like it is. But see, that's why we would really get along really good, him and I, she says of Trump, as if he might walk up the sidewalk at any minute. Because I'll tell it like it is, and if you don't like it, I don't really give a shit. The implied intimate and personal connection Dibble projects between herself and Trump is not uncommon among voters who fit the rough rebounder archetype. They watched Trump on primetime television and in entertainment rags for 20 years before he ran for office. They have seen him mocked and derided and isolated by people who they believe sit comfortably inside the economic and cultural balconies of America. They identify with his separation and see him, flawed as he is in his policy experience and personal character, as an authentically separate force that might serve as a counterbalance to things they no longer trust. A proxy for them in a battle they see themselves fighting in their own lives. I look at the world of politics totally different now than what I have in the past. You know, it's like you're trying to weigh things out when it comes to politicians. You're trying to weigh, you know, the good and the bad, this and the other. But from the beginning, with Trump, it was different for me. That will never leave me. Not because I am blind to his faults, but because the other politicians' faults are so worse. Because their failures were our lives, and that is unforgivable, she says. Outside, the lawnmower switches off, and her two Yorkies are ready for attention. Her son is ready to come in and play video games. She has other things for him to do. "Homework first," she says. He smiles. He knows this isn't a battle he will win. Chapter 5. Girl Gun Power. In modern national campaigns, there's no such thing as a secret strategy, and therefore almost no such thing as a tactic that goes ignored. During 2016's race, one of the most influential advertisers in the campaign spent over $35 million on a strategy that was largely unanswered by the other side. The National Rifle Association sought to persuade women that their self-defense rights would be at risk if Hillary Clinton got the opportunity to replace deceased pro-gun Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. The NRA's commitment to help Donald Trump was notable for several reasons. It was twice the size of any of its previous presidential efforts. It came in an impact-magnifying vacuum, with much of it airing before Trump himself had committed advertising dollars to his effort. And its video component targeted women almost exclusively, instead of focusing on the NRA's more traditional male membership base, associated with hunting and shooting sports. The NRA's contributions to Trump were noted immediately after the election, if not before. When it became clear in the wee hours of November 9th that Trump's Electoral College lead was unassailable, NBC News host Chuck Todd said, "Donald Trump did not get a lot of help from a lot of Republican institutions, but he did from the NRA, and they came through big. And this is a big night for the NRA, and they just bought a Supreme Court seat." While the NRA, one of the most established brands in American politics, spent tens of millions on this one issue, targeting true swing voters, Hillary Clinton and her supporters largely ignored it. Previous Democratic contenders had made a play for gun rights supporters. John Kerry went goose hunting with cameras in tow just before the 2004 election. And even President Barack Obama had assured voters that he regularly participated in skeet shooting at Camp David. Clinton took the opposite tack in 2016 and made a play to win the election partly on the strength of her pro-gun control stance. The Democratic National Convention prominently featured gun control advocates. Clinton's campaign website had an entire section devoted to her gun control positions, including a pledge to take on the gun lobby, a position in keeping with the principal wedge she drove in her nomination fight with Senator Bernie Sanders, a past NRA ally. Clinton's webpage on gun issues made no mention of the Second Amendment and offered none of the homage her predecessors had paid to the right to bear arms. Even Clinton herself had run to the right of Obama on guns in 2008. Post-election surveys indicate that the NRA accomplished its goal and found a vein of swing voters overlooked by most pundits and the Clinton campaign. The Great Revolt survey found that the one demographic group among Rust Belt Trump voters most likely to agree with the notion that every American has a fundamental right to self-defense and a right to choose the home defense firearm that is best for them is women under age 45. During the Obama years, the number of concealed handgun permits tripled to more than 16 million. Over 6% of all American adults now have carry permits. In Pennsylvania, a key state that Trump flipped from Obama's column, there are now more than a million permit holders. And in some counties, more than one-third of the adult population is licensed to carry. The NRA's own post-election survey of 8 battleground states showed that women under 45 are more likely to be interested in the gun rights issue based on self-defense grounds than for other reasons. The saliency of the issue of self-defense among women in that younger demographic was critical, because they were exactly the group most likely to bail on Trump in the wake of the revelation in October 2016 of the lewd comments he had made to Access Hollywood host Billy Bush. The Great Revolt survey results indicate that female Trump voters under age 45 were the most likely group to admit that, before the presidential election, they'd felt uncomfortable telling friends they supported Trump because they knew that they would disapprove. 34% of Rust Belt Trump voters identified with that sentiment in the survey, but a majority, 51%, of women under age 45 did so, the same voters who were most likely to take a strong self-defense position on gun rights. The success of Trump and the NRA in coalescing a key niche of younger women in an election in which every one of those votes mattered is the story of a voter archetype few saw coming, girl gun power. Amy Giles Maurer and Christine Baker Borglin. Kenosha, Kenosha County, Wisconsin. Amy Giles Maurer sits in the conference room of TG3 Electronics, the company where she works, along with other members of her family. She is the CFO. There are keyboards everywhere, not in a haphazard, sloppy way, but on display. Old ones, new ones, colorful ones, high-tech ones. If you can imagine a keyboard to suit your business's needs or your personal flair, it is here. The company, which started in her family's cellar after Maurer's father lost his job, makes both standard and custom keyboards for ambulances, hospitals, aircrafts, drive-through restaurants, and police cars. They also make bump bars, control panels, and custom display devices. My father started this company when I was in the fourth grade. It was started on the pool table in our basement, with a piece of plywood put over it. That was our assembly line, and my brother and I came home from school, and we would keycap. You know, you would grab the bag of W's, and you went around the table, and you put all the W's on the keyboards. And then you grabbed the bag of E's, you know, the next person in line, and so on, so that we were the assembly line. I learned how to solder at a young age, she says, of the process of fusing low melting point alloys with less fusible metals, one of the most fundamental skills needed in the field of electronics manufacturing. Although I didn't have to solder quite as much, and I've actually been doing payroll since I was 12, that was out of necessity because they didn't have anybody else to do it, she says. Maurer is a very striking woman. Her blonde hair cut short in the kind of dramatic fashion you would see in the pages of Vogue or on a Paris fashion runway. Her green eyes are large, her makeup is elegant, and at 43, she looks 10 years younger, with the obvious drive of a woman 20 years younger. She reels off the story of her life in a series of categories. Successful businesswoman, suburban mother of two, wife, civically engaged member of her community, and a feminist. And as she and her best friend, Christine Baker Borglin, discuss the merits of going to a Dixie Chicks concert, given the group's outspoken liberal political stances, she casually tells her interviewer that she is carrying. To me, being a feminist means being in control at all times of your destiny. That includes not just carrying a gun, but knowing how to use it, she states matter-of-factly. Got a couple in my office, she says of her firearms, pointing toward her office suite just outside the conference room. It's smart. It's empowering. It reminds me I am in charge of taking care of myself and my family at all times. This one here, she continues, pointing to Borglin. She carries now, too. She just got her concealed carry permit. The statuesque brunette smiles. Borglin is equally attractive. She in no uncertain terms looks less than her age of 49, and she bears an uncanny resemblance to the Ralph Lauren model whose classic brunette looks were the face of his women's clothing line during the 1970s. I have buildings up in the ghetto in Milwaukee and it's a dangerous area, says Borglund, who has an MBA and does contract work for the government. We've had people. Actually, we just had our security guard shot a couple weeks ago. We are sportsmen anyways. We like the right to have guns. But now, I actually conceal carry, because where I work, well, it's a dangerous area, she says. One of the things I think that Democrats did not understand about women and guns is that empowerment that a gun gives you, stresses Maurer. That you are the ultimate person in charge of yourself and all aspects, not just to carry. I was a single mom for a while. I've mowed the lawn with a child on my back in one of the backpack things. Don't tell me that I can't carry. Don't tell me that I can't do it on my own, says Maurer. And don't tell me that I'm not a feminist because I carry a gun. The right is the ultimate freedom, the ultimate empowerment, explains Borglund. TG3 is located in a sprawling industrial park in Kenosha County, Wisconsin, in a belt of similar light manufacturers and distribution centers running up the center of the county on either side of Interstate 94. The building is modern. The campus is well kept with trim lawns. It's a good example of the new economic face of a county that was once known for the cars that rolled off the American Motors Corporation and subsequently Chrysler assembly line in the older part of town. That car factory, built in 1902, was closed in 2010 and had its last remnants flattened by bulldozers in 2017. Outside, a storm is rolling in. The mid-afternoon sky, seen through the wall of glass, goes from flat gray to black in a startling fashion. Rain starts to pelt the glass wall as lightning streaks across the horizon. Maurer and Borglund are the kind of civically minded professional suburban women who had any number of reasons to take their practical moderate votes away from the Republican nominee, Donald J. Trump, and give them to Hillary Clinton. The Clinton campaign tried hard to win over women like them, with ads highlighting Trump's crudest misogynistic remarks, his sexist tropes from tabloid talk shows past, framing a picture of an unhinged troglodyte that no self-respecting woman could support, or let her friends support for that matter. They believed, I think, that the social pressure from either our friends or professional peers would be too much, that we would cave because of his behavior, says Maurer. Well, they misunderstood where the emphasis of our vote was. They thought, feminist, right? Successful? Kids in the home? Married? College educated? Oh, they cannot vote for Trump. They just cannot not. She smiles broadly. She turns to Borglund. They thought wrong. Clinton's campaign strategy succeeded to a point. Trump underperformed 2012 Republican nominee Mitt Romney's vote tallies with women in general, white women in particular, and with suburban women. A large survey of voters in 8 presidential target states, taken by Republican pollster Wes Anderson of On Message Inc. days after the election, found that 16% of Clinton's total voters said the reason they voted for her was Trump's inappropriate language and behavior regarding women. But Trump held on to just enough of those women to win. Wisconsin by 22,748 votes, Michigan by 10,704, and Pennsylvania by 44,292. Those 3 states had all voted Democratic in the 6 previous presidential contests, but switched sides to deny Hillary Clinton's bid to become the first woman president. With a combined decisive margin of merely 77,744 people out of 13.97 million votes cast in those states, the few narrow slices of votes that defied the larger political trends and resisted the full thrust of the losing campaign's appeals merit the most study. As the campaign progressed, few pundits focused on the prospect that there might be a credible cluster of women who would reluctantly stick with Trump based on the issue of gun rights. but the evidence was there in the form of a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court left vacant by the death of Antonin Scalia. That vacancy would loom large in voters' minds, and the Democratic nominee willingly made it loom larger still. As Clinton navigated her way through a tougher-than-expected nomination fight against Senator Bernie Sanders, she created a general election vulnerability that no recent Democratic nominee had. She ran hard in support of gun control. Political strategists on both sides of the aisle know it's a truism of politics that gun rights supporters are more likely to vote on the issue than gun rights opponents. In the first Democratic debate in October 2015, Clinton was asked by moderator Anderson Cooper which enemy she was most proud of, and the first one out of her mouth was the NRA. Two of the general election debates dwelled extensively on gun rights and the 2008 Supreme Court decision in District of Columbia versus Heller, in which a 5-4 majority ruled for the first time in history that the right to self-defense is fundamental, individual, and protected by the Second Amendment to the Constitution. A Scalia-written opinion on a case that Clinton said was wrongly decided. For its part, the NRA responded to Hillary's challenge, endorsed Trump earlier than it had ever endorsed a presidential candidate, and spent tens of millions independently on his behalf. The NRA's advertising in this race wasn't just different from its efforts in previous races in scope and timing, it was different in tone and target. Focused squarely on persuading women in the suburbs and exurbs of a Supreme Court pick's ramifications for self-defense rights. While women in general are less supportive of gun rights than men are, by pushing herself to the extremes of anti-gun policy, Clinton created a soft spot with just enough women in the political middle, and the NRA capitalized on it. Trump repaid the favor, speaking of his support for the Second Amendment and of his NRA endorsement more frequently and more explicitly than his predecessors had. For a candidate who eschewed connections with most of the constellation of ideologically conservative organizations, Trump's embrace of the NRA was striking. By Election Day, 2/3 of voters in Pennsylvania and Ohio told pollster Anderson that they were aware of Trump's position on gun rights. And by wide margins, voters in that group who lived in suburbs, exurbs, small towns, and rural areas said Trump's support made them more likely to vote for him. A full 88% of all voters Anderson surveyed in 8 target states said the Supreme Court issue was important to deciding their vote, with Trump voters more likely to say the issue was extremely important. For Maurer and Borglin and others in their cohort, it took the course of the campaign to convince them, and Trump's peccadilloes got in the way. Neither Maurer nor Borglin had Trump on the top of her personal list when the 17 Republican candidates walked out on the stage for the first GOP debate in Cleveland in August 2015. And at times, long after the election, Trump still rubs them the wrong way. But the vote was larger than him. It was about us, our families, and our community, and the preservation of our rights, says Maurer. Maurer grew up in Kenosha in a 2-parent family with 1 sibling. They're still married, although they bicker a lot, she says of her parents and business partners. They get on each other's nerves, she says, smiling as if remembering an incident earlier in the day. I have 1 older brother who is 4 years older, and he has the office right next to mine. Is that good? Sometimes, she says, laughing. So, my dad was raised by his grandparents after his parents had to get married when they were young. When he was born, they divorced, and neither of them really wanted him, so he lived with his maternal grandparents. He went into the Marines right out of high school, just volunteered, and he was sent to Vietnam where he fixed F-4 Phantoms, she says, referring to the tandem, two-seat, twin-engine, all-weather, long-range supersonic jet interceptor and fighter bomber used extensively during the Southeast Asian conflict. He picked up electronics there in the Marines. As a kid, he was always kind of naturally technical, and they utilized his skills, she explains. After Vietnam, her father got a job at Delco in Milwaukee, where the company was helping to design navigational systems for the Boeing 747 and for the space program. From there, he went to Cherry Electronics in Waukegan, a family-run business where he stayed for quite a while. She explains, he was downsized in the mid-80s. They were cutting out their keyboard division, which he was the head of, and so, with the president of Cherry's blessing, he started his business, TG3, which is derived from his name, Thomas Giles III. Maurer's upbringing was pretty middle class, she says. Her mother, who was born in Mississippi but moved north with her parents as an infant, came from a Democratic family whose father worked construction. Grandpa also owned some of his own excavating equipment, and so he would do side jobs, you know, for extra money, she explains. Politics at home, for her, was centered on who was best for a family struggling to make a small business work. Growing up with the business, she says, I always knew every year at a certain date when my parents met with the accountant when I was little. I mean, a lot of times my mom would come home crying with what they owed in taxes, because when it's half of what you've made for the year, things are tough. As a kid in junior high school, I can remember my mother telling me, if your father and I ever get hit by a car, don't call Nanny and Grandpa, don't call your aunts, your uncles, call the attorney and the accountant, because you know things have to get set into motion because of the death tax, Maurer recalls, of the ramifications of the federal estate tax. Her parents most certainly were Republicans when she was growing up. We started talking politics a little bit in high school. I wouldn't say they were Republicans to the point where we do today, but sure, my senior year, I was 18, and I voted for Ross Perot on my own. My parents didn't, you know, tell me one way or the other, but he was for a flat tax, and that made sense to me, she says. Maurer did not go into the family business right after she graduated from Marquette, a Jesuit university 39 miles north of Kenosha in Milwaukee. I actually dabbled in speech pathology for a while, and then every summer the business seemed to need a receptionist, so I was the receptionist for the summer. All the while, I still was doing payroll, so I was doing accounts payable, payroll, that kind of stuff for the summers, and then just kind of got a little bit more immersed. My mother was always the financial person, and my dad was the technical person. So it was sort of natural that I kind of took over for her. For her older brother, it was easy. He always knew he wanted to work in the family business, she says, while her transition was more gradual. I guess part of it was a sense of loyalty. There's a sense of who else is going to run it and care about it as much as somebody in the family. Many of her employees have been there for what she says seems like forever. We've got employees here that are, I mean, quite honestly, most of the people here are like family, Maurer says. We've got a large engineering department. We have an assembly line. People run machinery, quality, purchasing, accounting, and sales and marketing. 35 employees in total. Her father is technically still the CEO. Her uncle, who is closer to her age than her parents' age, is the president. There is also my mom's brother. Sometimes it can get heated. She explains of the complexities of integrating family and business life. But there is a lot of satisfaction of having something like this in my hometown. I think we fly under the radar a little bit because we're not a retail store. We don't make things like Case Tractors, which is a household name. You know, if you're using our product, you probably have no idea that it's our product, she says of the keyboards under many of our fingers every day. Most of our employees, I would say over 90% of them, have been here for 10 years. Finding new employees is difficult now, though. We don't have young people coming in wanting to do assembly work. Even if you do pay the magical $15 an hour, and you offer benefits that nobody else offers, she says, explaining how they provide unconventional perks for employees, including trips to sporting events, such as Green Bay Packers games. We've flown them to Dallas for Packers games, playoff games, so you know we try to treat everybody really well, she says, noting how hard it is to attract and retain skilled workers. I think you find young people don't want to do this type of assembly work and be machine operators. Quite honestly, I think when the government got involved in making school loans their business so that everybody could go to college, and they promoted the notion that everybody should go to college, I think they're doing a huge disservice to the trades. I think you could make a very good living in the trades. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, she says, echoing a common theme of employers and economic development recruiters interviewed across Trump country. Maurer says that in 10 to 15 years, tradespeople are going to be able to write their own ticket because there are going to be so few of them. We're always going to need a plumber. We're always going to need an electrician, somebody to work on your car. And as much as automation does come into our lives, there's still going to be people who need to repair the machines. The machine operators and repair and setup. We would pay well for that, she says. Maurer's prediction of talent demand may prove right sooner than she thinks. In the summer of 2017, Wisconsin officials inked a deal with Taiwanese electronics giant Foxconn, contract manufacturer of the Apple iPhone in its Asian factories, to open a new 3,000-employee plant in southeast Wisconsin, just north of Kenosha in Racine. The deal, announced by Trump and House Speaker Paul Ryan in a White House event, will create a new generation of advanced manufacturing jobs requiring high levels of engineering skills, skills sorely lacking in the American workforce, according to Wired magazine. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker was Maurer's candidate when the process started in the Republican primary in 2015. I still like him, she says of the governor, who is now seeking his third term in office. Walker lost Kenosha County in a 2012 recall election, but he won it in 2014. He generally gets high marks from business people in the county who feel the positive effect of the state's tax and regulatory framework. Situated directly on the border between the two states, on a major interstate highway, Kenosha County has been a natural landing spot for Illinois companies looking for a lower-cost location that lets them remain in outer Chicagoland. The last 5 to 7 years, it's been a pretty steady stream of new investments, says Todd Battle, president of the Kenosha Area Business Alliance. You could probably tie the timeline to the election of Governor Walker, as far as Wisconsin having a fairly strong emphasis on its business climate and its tax policy, he says, echoing a sentiment heard frequently in the county. For Maurer, Walker's aw-shucks Midwestern temperament was a more comfortable fit than Trump's New York bad boy bawdiness. Sometimes Trump, oh, I mean, he just causes his own problems, she says. When the Access Hollywood tape came out in the fall of 2016, she was not thrilled. It was not his proudest moment, and President Trump was not my first choice. But when it came down to Hillary Clinton or him, well, I was more concerned with what she was hiding. I always knew what he stood for, because he always puts it out there. Yes, it's not always put out there in the most elegant ways, but it's there. She made the transition to Trump much more quickly than Borglin, who was stalled by his unorthodox behavior. So, Walker was my first choice too, and then Ted Cruz, Borglin says. I didn't like that Trump tweeted. I didn't like that he just wouldn't take his turn at the debates. I mean, I went to the debate in Milwaukee, and I rolled my eyes. I still do. There were plenty of times where I was like, all right, you don't need to tweet. I get now, though, that he's kind of bypassed the media to get his own message out. Borglund's life was not too different from that of a military brat. We moved a lot. My dad worked in retail, so he started off being like an assistant manager, then general manager, then buyer, then regional manager, she says. In total, we moved about 12 different times. My parents had me when they first started college, and my mom dropped out then to have me, and then had two sisters after that. And my dad, it was during that time where middle managers were all different ranks, just kept progressing through and getting moved. So we lived everywhere in Iowa, she explains. My mom stayed home, and she babysat kids out of the house for a while, and my dad worked two jobs at times. So we were definitely middle class. Both parents were very conservative. Dad has always been very vocal about it, and even now, with retiring, they get together their little politics group, and they complain and everything else. Borglund's mom struggled with Trump's antics, too. I think this election took a big toll on my mother. She is so conservative, but very quiet, she says. After college, she went to work for publisher McGraw-Hill on Aerospace Daily. And that was right when the Persian Gulf War came out, so I was an editorial assistant. We covered a lot of the procurement and the deployment during that time, and I was still very conservative-minded. She was in Chicago when she met her husband. Then we moved to London, lived there for a couple years, and I worked in government relations, she says, explaining that her job there was for Nortel, looking at emerging markets for the then telecommunications giant. When their first child was about to arrive, they moved back home to the American heartland. I wanted my children to grow up around family, she says. We tried the suburbs of Chicago, which was very impersonal. So, since his family is up here, we moved up to Wisconsin. That was 15 years ago. Amy and Christine first met when their children were attending the same Montessori school. We both had volunteered to do fundraising activities, Borglund says. All of my female friends are successful in their own right. One runs a division of a company where she works, another holds office, another runs a large company, and another is the main breadwinner in the family. I guess I gravitate towards strong women. I just do. My father raised me to be a feminist, says Borglund. She believes that the women's political movement has lost its way. I saw the footage from the women's rally they had the day after Trump's inauguration, and you saw women there and their daughters dressed like vaginas. And I wonder how they think that makes us feel stronger about our accomplishments. Maurer says that while she remains a more traditional Republican, she accepts that motivations are changing, and we might be seeing something new after the 2016 election. She places the responsibility for what she calls this new alignment of voters back on the political class in Washington. It is not our fault that they stopped listening to our concerns, and that they stopped being connected to the places they come from. Not only do they not hold any of those values anymore, they look down at you for that. That goes not just for politicians, it's cultural. It's in how we purchase our clothes and necessities. It is how we shop, how we consume our music and our entertainment. There has been sort of this seismic shift. People stop and they react, not only in what their choices are in politics, but just in other choices, period. I think that part of the Trump election was not that it was not just about Trump. I think this was about something much bigger. It was about things changing and trying to get more control of it, because things are getting out of hand, Borglund says. The one thing that this election did for me is just dissolve trust in, like the media, for instance. I know that is now a cliche, but hear me out. I took journalism courses as part of my English and political science degree. And it was always, you follow the truth and you follow the story. And I started to realize that historically, when you judge what revolutions or what countries go through, I realized that our media had become propagandist. And that was frightening to me, especially with social media.